There's a particular sound that marks the end of childhood. Not a dramatic crash, but something quieter, more insidious. For the Carrot sisters, it's the metallic rumble of the Dawn streetcar outside their new, smaller apartment on Rue Cherrier. Their father is dead. Their mother, only 27, has moved them from comfort to survival. In the bedroom they now share, Berthe invents elaborate stories to calm her frightened younger sister Marie, spinning fantasies that serve as both distraction and shelter. What makes this moment so devastating isn't the grief itself, but how it manifests. In the unfamiliar echoes of cramped rooms, in the intrusive sounds their old home had been too far away to hear, in the way their mother breaks down at dinner while trying to maintain the polished brass and pressed linens of their former life. This is how loss actually works, not in grand gestures, but in the thousand small adjustments we make to accommodate absence. The children don't philosophize about death. They simply notice that everything sounds different now, that shadows fall in unfamiliar patterns, that their mother's hands shake while she sews for families who once invited her as a guest. An $18,000 inheritance transforms the Corrette family's prospects. When Marie falls for a Greek immigrant, her mother intervenes, arranging for Louis Driscoll, French in all but name, to court her instead. Louis arrives nearsighted, clutching chocolates, wearing a beige tweed coat and bottle green hat. Awkwardly acceptable, but not Marie's choice. His proposal wraps practicality in urgency. War has broken out in Korea. Bachelors will be drafted first. Marriage offers protection. During the wedding, Berthe weeps over Marie's acceptance of an unlucky ring from a dead woman. Afterward, their mother delivers a loaded command: wait until I am dead before you get married. What sounds like maternal devotion is actually a claim of ownership. Marriage represents transfer of loyalty rather than expansion of love. The sisters' private mockery of Louis carves out tiny spaces of resistance within systems designed to limit their choices. Raymond receives his father's deathbed wisdom in neat packages. There have always been good jobs in Boston. Never forget your French. Marry a Catholic, but not just any Catholic. These maxims distill generations of cultural survival into practical advice. Raymond absorbs it all, then promptly disappears to join the Marines, settling in Florida and never returning to Montreal. When Marie visits for the eighth time, she carries static electricity that shocks Berthe at every touch, a perfect metaphor for displacement, for the disruptive energy created when family members move between incompatible worlds. During dinner, Raymond introduces a skinny woman with corkscrew blonde hair as Mimi, his wife. Marie immediately questions whether they married in church, whether Mimi is even a real name. When Raymond storms out, Mimi reveals her pregnancy, news he hasn't shared with his mother. Despite limited English, Marie attempts comfort, assuring Mimi that the baby would have a grandmother and Berthe regardless of Raymond's behavior. As she embraces her daughter-in-law, Marie feels a spark of electricity through her chiffon sleeve, interpreting it as an approving message from Berthe. The static that once symbolized disconnection now becomes a bridge between generations. In Paris, 14-year-old Pascal Brouet observes his family like rugby players, remembering his father's explanation of Celtic singing before Roman conquest. His parents met during the May 1968 protests, revolutionaries turned comfortable bourgeoisie, his father now a magistrate reading newspapers while dozing in sunlight. The central figure is Uncle Amadé, called Dédé, a tall, curly-haired student whom Pascal once wanted to emulate by becoming a bachelor. During Sunday lunch, the family discusses corrupt candidates, while Dédé, despite being old enough to vote, still needs guidance after accidentally setting fires and forging checks. When another fire is discovered in his room, the magistrate arranges for him to leave that night. A year later, Dédé lives in Paris working for a television polling service, but the Brouets never contact him. This abrupt excision reveals how families sometimes solve problems through elimination rather than integration. Pascal's mother loves her brother, yet that love has limits when weighed against respectability, forcing us to consider the price of maintaining appearances and the boundaries of family loyalty.
After 24 years in the Republic of Saltnatec, Dr. Dominic Misiarna returns to Europe expecting recognition for establishing its first modern university and documenting an unknown language. At a Helsinki Linguistics Congress, colleagues confuse Saltnatec with other places and respond with indifference. Europe has grown small and depleted in spirit during his absence. Now divorced and aging, he contemplates visiting estranged children for Christmas, wondering what gifts might bridge decades of distance. An actuarial study gives him 6 years to live. He regrets mentioning that the village children were beautiful and wanted motorcycles, fearing it might attract exploitative scholars, a concern revealing genuine care for the community he studied. He decides never to return to Saltnatec, choosing to live out his remaining years in Europe while wondering if he might have lived longer in Saltnatec's clearer air. What makes this poignant isn't just the indifference he faces, but his own complicity. His isolation stems from personality and choices as much as others' neglect. The story asks, what is the value of work done in obscurity? Can meaning exist without recognition? Years after Medazel Diaz de Corta briefly lived in her apartment, the summer before abortion became legal in France, the narrator still keeps her nearly weightless suitcase. Their arrangement deteriorated room by room, bedroom to living room to behind a screen in the hallway, a physical manifestation of gradual marginalization. When questioned about origins, Medazel Diaz de Corta insisted she was French despite having no passport. The narrator discovered her pregnancy, but refused to help with an abortion. After spending a night with Robert in his Renault, the young woman received advice from a stranger in a cafe and disappeared. Years later, they spot her in a television commercial for oven cleanser, transformed with short mahogany-tinted hair and a wider smile. The narrator calculates she owes 1,500 new francs, but wants only the pleasure of seeing you and hearing from your own lips what you are proud of and what you regret. The preserved suitcase becomes a metaphor for holding space for people who briefly pass through our lives, carrying the weight of connections we never fully understood. 17-year-old Nora Abbott first sees Neil Fenton in a Catholic orphanage, a frail 3-month-old with the face of a disconnected old man. Despite his rigid, tense body and opaque gaze, he responds when her dark hair falls around him. At the Fenton's home, the real Mrs. Fenton is knocked out by the heat upstairs, showing no interest in her new son. Nora's father, Ray, runs a side business connecting childless couples with unwanted babies. When Nora witnesses suspicious registration errors on Neil's birth certificate that no one corrects, she begins understanding this arrangement's questionable nature. Mr. Fenton reveals he paid Ray $30, money she never received. When her mother tells her to forget the child, Nora silently resolves to remember. He will remember that I picked him up. I'll try to remember him. It's the best I can do. Sometimes the most radical act is refusing to forget someone the world wants erased, insisting that every life deserves to be witnessed and held in someone's heart.